time. Time. Time is an interesting thing. Time often feels like it's moving too fast or too slow, doesn't it? Time can sometimes feel like a punishment. Sometimes, and by that I mean our world, the lives we're living, just kind of feel like it's too much all at once. If things could just slow down. We can't even seem to process what is happening, much less what has happened and what may happen. Time just keeps rolling over us. Actually, there's an old band that wrote a song about this. Have you all ever heard of Hootie and the Blowfish? Maybe you've heard of Darius Rucker. So in 1994, they wrote a song called Time. Part of it goes like this. Time, why do you punish me? Like a wave crashing into the shore, you wash away my dreams. Time, why do you walk away? Like a friend with somewhere to go, you left me crying. Time, you left me standing there like a tree growing all alone. The wind just stripped me bare. Time, the past has come and gone. The future is far away, now only lasts for 1 second. Can you teach me about tomorrow and all the pain and sorrow running free? Because tomorrow's just another day and I don't believe in time. Time without courage, time without fear is just wasted, wasted, wasted time. Time, why do you punish me? Time, why? Do you ever feel the punishment of time? You may not have heard of Darius Rucker or Hootie and the Blowfish, but you may have heard of Isaac Watts. In 1719, he wrote a hymn called O God, Our Help in Ages Past. In that hymn, Watts says, time, like an ever-rolling stream, bears all its sons away. Do you see what he's saying? Time inevitably just washes it all away. All of us are washed away with time. Boy, that's a hopeful way to begin the sermon, isn't it? Like, where are you going with this, John? Where's the hope in that? Well, here's where we're going. We're going to go to what you could say is one of the most depressing books, but actually is one of the most hopeful books in the Bible, Ecclesiastes. Ecclesiastes. So find Ecclesiastes. In Ecclesiastes, which is right after Proverbs, right before Song of Solomon, we're going to be chapter 3, page 519, the pew Bibles in front of you. In Ecclesiastes, we're going to see in chapter 3 a whole poem about time. See, I say poem, okay? But Nick has corrected me that that's not how you say it. It's poem, apparently. But where I'm from, we say poem, okay? So can we go with that? Are y'all going to judge me if I go a little East Texas on you? Yes, okay. Poem, which makes no sense. Not P-O-I-M, it's P-O-E-M. But anyways, East Texas, here we go. So in Ecclesiastes 3, 1 through 8, we're going to get to 9 through 15 eventually. Just let's start with 1 through 8 to try to set the stage for 9 through 15. There's this poem that I would say Solomon, the teacher, the Kohelet, the professor, who's writing Ecclesiastes, he writes about time and the sense of the monotonous movement of time. So let's look at the poem, 1 through 8, and then we'll talk about that and then move to 9 through 15. So Ecclesiastes 3:1, for everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down, a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. So Solomon's poem is about the inevitable monotonous flow of life. This idea that life really, there's a sameness to life. We all are born, we live, we love, we work, and we die. And nothing ever, think of it, nothing ever changes for the human race. Nothing ever changes. Born, live, love, work, die. Every human, everywhere. Which, by the way, no wonder our lives can feel so meaningless. No wonder we can be overcome by despair. More on why despair is a good thing in a minute. We're here today and gone tomorrow. Rucker says, can you teach me about tomorrow? Tomorrow's just another day. I don't believe in time. I'm done with this idea of time. Time is just a punishment. It's just a monotonous, ever-rolling stream washing all of its sons away. What's the point? Now, actually in the poem, Solomon doesn't evaluate the movement of time as good or bad. He's just describing the seasons of life. I've already started to do some of what he does in verses 9 through 15. In 9 through 15, he starts to reflect on 1 through 8, the poem he's written about time. In 9 through 15, we're going to get a sense on what he thinks about this flow, this monotonous flow of the stream of time. So let's look at 9 through 15. What gain has the worker from his toil? I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity into man's heart. Yet, so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also, that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people fear before him. That which is already has been, that which is to be already has been, and God seeks what has been driven away. So Solomon starts to reflect on the poem of 1 through 8. Verse 9 restates what he's already said. Verse 9, what gain has the worker from his toil? He's actually restating really where he started in chapter 1, verse 3. Chapter 1, 3, what does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? In other words, what gain is there in a world where God has imposed a curse on all activity because of sin? What gain is there? Verse 1, chapter 1, 3, what gain? 3, 9, what gain? What gain is there with this flow of time, these seasons of life? What gain is there? Well, in a sense, the answer is, the poem's answer is nothing's gained. There is no gain. The teacher is saying there's no gain because everything's nullified by the curse. There's no net gain because nothing fundamentally changes. There's always more work to do, more dishes to wash, more wars to fight, more babies to raise. There's no gain. So verses 1 through 8 is hinting at this great absurdity of life. Each activity, did you notice how each activity cancels out the other? This is brilliant writing, brilliant poetry. Each activity cancels out the other. Time to be born, time to die. Plant, pluck up what is planted. Kill, heal. So, yeah, by the way, if you count them, there's 14 pluses and 14 minuses. So the net gain is what? Zero. Zero. Everything that's built up is torn down. Everything we keep is eventually lost. Every birth eventually ends in death. One commentator says, life is a big non-plus. We seek meaning in all of our activities. We seek meaning in all these different seasons and times, and then we come away from each and every one of them still frustrated, still wondering if there's any meaning. This is what Solomon goes on to say. Let's keep going. Verse 10, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. So verse 10, he's actually restating what he said in chapter 1, verse 13. So go to chapter 1, 13. I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. And here it is. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Do you see the parallel? It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. And then 3:10, I have seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Now back in 1:13, it says unhappy business. There's a qualifier. There's an adjective. That word unhappy can literally mean evil or miserable or grievous. There's a grievous business that God has given us, a miserable, evil. The word literally means evil. There's an evil, I've seen the evil business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. Again, do you see, you can probably understand why Ecclesiastes is one of the, on first reading, one of the most depressing books in the Bible. I think actually, the more you read it and the longer you live, the more you come to love this book, by the way. Because there's just a ring of truth all over it. So he's restating 1:13. He's referring back to this unhappy business. Now, why does he do that right here after this poem on time? Well, he hasn't commented on the positive or negative value of time in the poem, but now he is. He's giving it a negative evaluation. He's saying it's an unhappy business. All these seasons, all these activities, all this ever-rolling stream of time that washes all the suns away. This is an unhappy business, an evil business even. The unhappy business of man is to toil through life, to get on the ever-flowing stream and just ride it till it ends. That's our business. That's our lot. Why? Because God imposed a curse upon the world because of Adam and Eve's sin. We live in a world under a God-imposed curse. So that's why Ecclesiastes, that's why I think we love this book. This book is so realistic. It really grapples with the fallenness of the entire world and the brokenness of our entire life. I had Mason do a check on the Hebrew, but it's interesting that verse 9 uses the word toil. What gain has the worker from his toil? Genesis 3 doesn't use that word exactly or specifically, but when God curses first the serpent and then Adam and Eve, what's the result of that? Especially Adam. He will work the ground through toil. So you can see the connection, the theological connection here between Adam and Eve's fall into sin, the human race, all of creation now under sin, and the result is what? Toil. 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 Our frustration is a God-enforced burden because of the curse of sin. Now, why? Why would God set it up this way? This brings us to our main text for today, verse 11. The next verse tells us why this is the case. Look at verse 11 and we'll camp here for a bit. Verse 11, God has made everything beautiful. Your translation might say appropriate. He has made everything appropriate in its time. Also, He has put eternity into man's heart. Yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. So verse 11 has three clauses. I want to take one clause at a time, talk about one clause at a time, and then ask if these three clauses fit together and try to see how they fit together and what they have to teach us. And by the way, you're wondering, you're like, hey, I thought we were doing a series on heaven. Where is it? I'll show you where this is going in just a second, how this points us and kind of will launch us into our series on heaven. The first clause in verse 11 says that God made everything beautiful or appropriate in its time. There's so many links here in this verse back to Genesis 1 through 3. First, though, he links us back to the poem, time. Everything beautiful in its time. So he's linking back to the poem of verses 1 through 8. And he's letting us know that he's now commenting on what he's just said about time. God made everything. That's what we find in Genesis 1, the creation account, where God made everything. Then it says he made everything appropriate or beautiful, meaning that in the beginning everything was right and good and worked properly and everything fit together. Everything had its own place and own time and nothing broke. I think it was Hunter in the class this morning was like, the longer he's an engineer, the more he believes in the fall into sin because nothing works right. Did you say that, Hunter? Where are you, Hunter? Kids, sweet. I think he said that. Nothing works right. Nothing works right. But in the beginning, everything worked right. Everything was beautiful in its time. Everything was appropriate. Everything fit together and was good and right and beautiful in the beginning. So the first phrase, verse 11, means that God is the one in charge of these times and activities. He's ordained, He created the world, and He set history in motion. Even all the toil and the curse of sin, He's ordained these things as part of His plan for the world. He made the world, and He's in charge of the world. Now the next phrase is the famous one. It says, also he has put eternity into man's heart. He's put eternity into man's heart. Eternity. So all of a sudden he jumps from time to eternity. Do you see what he's doing? He's contrasting time. He used the word time 29 times in that poem. And now he all of a sudden mentions eternity. He's drawn a con. What does this contrast mean? What are you doing, Solomon? He's saying, yes, we live in a seemingly meaningless flow of events, flow of activities, flow of time. We live in the crawl of time, but even in that crawl of time, in the smallness of time, we have something God-sized in our hearts. Even though we creep through time with all of its pluses and minuses, we do so with something of the very nature of God inside of us. Eternality. It says he put eternity into our hearts. Who's eternal? God. It's one of his attributes. It's who he is. He has no beginning, no end. He simply is. Eternality is an attribute of God. So when it says God put eternity into our hearts, it means he put something of himself into us. This is analogous to being made in the image of God. Yes, we're made out of the dust, but we have something of God. We have something spiritual in us. We're made out of material, but we have something immaterial. In other words, this verse is saying God has put something big inside our little lives, inside our little hearts. Why is Solomon telling us this? Why does he bring this up? Why does he go from saying all this flow of time, the pluses and minuses, all of this is true, and you're traveling through this river of time with eternity in your hearts. Why is he telling us that? He's telling us that because he's trying to point out, hey, this is why your life feels so meaningless. This is why we know that time isn't all there is. This is why we all intuitively feel that there's something else beyond this world that we were made for. Something that the flow, the ups and downs of life just doesn't seem to satisfy or quench. There's a longing in us that's beyond this life because we have eternity in our hearts. We have something of God, something of heaven in our hearts. Now, we'll come back to this idea in a minute, but first, the last phrase. It's important for us to put it all together. It's written all together. So, everything beautiful in its time, eternity in our hearts, yet, so we have eternity in our hearts, yet, we cannot find out what God has done from the beginning or the end. You have eternity in your heart, but oh, by the way, you're not going to ever figure all this out. You're not ever going to really grasp what God's up to from beginning to the end. We're like children who ask why about everything. The question, you know, if you have kids, the question, you explain something and then why. Explanation why. And finally, you just get to the point where you say, because I said so. You know, that's just the way it is. I'm not going to answer why. I can't answer why anymore. This is just the way it is. We can't handle all the whys of God's work in the world. We can barely handle a sliver of what he's up to in the world. Our problem is that we think we know and can understand more than we actually can. But yet eternity is in our hearts. God has put eternity into our hearts. We know there's something more out there, but we can't get a handle on it. We can't seem to grasp it. We're trapped in between time and eternity. We're trapped in between time and eternity with no way of escape. So what do we do? What do we do? Well, if you keep reading, verse 12, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. So what do you do in this? When you're trapped in between time and eternity, what do you do? It says it right there. be joyful, do good, enjoy food and drink in moderation, okay? Non-alcoholic beverages, of course. And look at it. Take pleasure in your toil? What? You want me to enjoy my work? For this is God's gift to man. He's saying, you don't understand a sliver of what God's up to. So just look at what's right in front of you. Be faithful and even joyful. Even joyful with those things right in front of you. And stop trying to figure out all of it. God's up to something bigger and grander and more beautiful than we can imagine. And the mundane and repetitive and seemingly monotonous and meaningless details of our lives, we can't see the whole picture. So he's saying you have to learn how to trust the one who's drawing the picture. We have to learn that God is doing something in our lives, whether we see it or not. That nothing is wasted. Didn't we just sing this in Christ is mine forever? Not even our pain is wasted. My pain will not be wasted. Nothing goes to waste in God's universe. So we just keep going to work. We keep eating. We keep drinking. We keep doing good. And we do all of that with our hearts turned to God. This is kind of what he's getting at in verse 14. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it or anything taken from it. God has done it. Why? So that people should fear him. So lift your gaze upward. Your life feels meaningless. The flow of time is washing over you and it's frustrating. It feels like punishment. Lift your gaze upward and trust the author, trust the maker, trust the artist. As you go about the mundane and meaningless details of your life. Now, God has given us the interesting, this is almost like the gospel in like hidden form. It's right there in that phrase, eternity in our hearts. That's where we're going to kind of camp. So in the middle of all that I've just described, God says, I put eternity into your hearts. Why? So that you can know. You don't need a preacher to tell you. You can know that there is a God who made you, who you're accountable to, who loves you and wants to be in relationship with you. In other words, you can know that you were actually made for something bigger than the meaningless life that you live. He put eternity into our hearts to lift our eyes to Him. So, of course, we live in a world of toil. And so in our toil, often, if you're like me, in our toil, we end up focusing just on the circumstances, on the pain and the sorrow and the relational strain and the whatever tension, whatever work stuff or money stuff, like we're just consumed with the toil. What God actually wants to do is to use that toil to lift our eyes to Him. And the toil actually shows us that there are unfulfilled longings and unfulfilled desires in our hearts. We want deep and growing relationships, but we keep hitting our head against the wall. We can't seem to really reach the bottom of that. But ask yourself, why do you want a deep and growing relationship? You want to flourish in your work. You want to create and excel and be a blessing, but you just can't. Your work just feels like a beating. Well, have you asked why the longing? Why the desire? Why do you want to do good? You want people to be blessed, but it seems like people are always misunderstanding you or you're always annoyed. But have you asked yourself, where's the longing? A lot of times, in other words, we focus on the negative. But what if we're missing some of the main ways God is speaking to us? These desires, these longings, eternity in your heart. He's giving you desires. To be creative, to bless others, to build deep and meaningful relationships, to know and honor God. Our unfulfilled longings can lead us into despair and often do, but our despair is meant to lead us to God. One commentator says, we perceive and long for better things than this cursed misery. We perceive and long for better things. only when, I think, when we honestly acknowledge that, when we honestly acknowledge the meaninglessness of our lives apart from God, will we then finally come to Him. Let me put it this way. Think about Jesus' ministry in the Gospels. Oftentimes, as I'm trying to say, despair, a lot of times we're like, despair is bad, I just need to get rid of despair and be more positive. But what if, I think this is Ecclesiastes, what if despair is God's gift to you? What if despair is God's way of saying, you were made for something bigger than this little world? So in the Gospels, who does Jesus gravitate to? Why does Jesus gravitate towards the despairing? The leper who no one would touch. The tax collector who people hated. The Samaritan woman. The woman caught in adultery. The lame. The blind man on the road to Jericho who was sitting there and no one noticed him. The thief on the cross. Why is Jesus drawn to the despairing? And why is he so pointed and harsh towards the religious and proud and smug? They got it all together and they got an answer for everything. Because Jesus came for people who know that they're sick. He came for people who know that they need a doctor. He didn't come for the people who already think they're good. The smug and self-righteous. In other words, people in despair are exactly the kind of people Jesus is looking for. So why are you hiding your despair? Why are you working so hard to cover up the stuff that is plaguing your life and your heart and your thoughts? Jesus came for the broken. It's the sick who know they need a doctor, not the healthy. What if despair is meant to drive us to God? What if our despair is a gift from God meant to lead us to God? God put eternity into our hearts. He put something big into our little lives. Our lives are meaningless, but He put something in that meaninglessness called eternity in our hearts. Why? To lift our gaze to Him. To lift our eyes off of time and onto eternity. So Solomon, I love this book because Solomon perceived the emptiness of this world and that God made us for something bigger and better. In other words, Solomon understood that this idea of kind of positive agnosticism, you know, that there probably isn't a God, or I don't really know if there's a God, but we should be good anyways. He's like, no, that's ridiculous. This life is hard, but there's something bigger than this life for you to lift your eyes to. There is a point. Solomon understood the reality of meaninglessness that we feel. He believed that there was a deeper meaning to be found under and even in the meaninglessness that the mundane, the steady flow of time that washes over us and feels like a punishment. He understood that there was a meaning in Solomon understood that there was a meaning in life. And that it had nothing to do with your circumstances. It had to do with whether or not you know and fear God. That's how he ends the book. What does he say? I've summed it all up. What should we do? Fear God and keep His commands. Now, of course, our modern society struggles to come up with reasons for meaning in life that go beyond personal expression. This is a huge, I'm going to do a little bit of apologetics here for a few minutes. This is huge. As you're talking to people, especially people who are agnostic or atheistic or just kind of denying God, like, I really think for them to be logically consistent, if you deny God, you don't have a foundation for meaning. If you came from nowhere, you came from meaninglessness and you're headed to meaninglessness, then to say that your life somehow has meaning is totally illogical. Now, I wouldn't say it quite so sharply, maybe, to your friend over coffee, but you should say that in some way. Our modern society struggles to come up with reasons for meaning that go beyond personal expression. So Peter Kreeft wrote a book, Roman Catholic apologist, philosopher. Kreeft wrote a book on heaven back in 1980. I wasn't even born yet, but it was really timely. He explains our society perfectly 43 years ago. He explains our society's condition like this, and it's worth quoting at length. Creef says, "Most people in our modern Western society do not have any clear or solid answer to the question, what's the point of life? Most of us live without knowing what we live for. Surely this is life's greatest tragedy, far worse than death. Living for no reason is not living, but mere existing, mere surviving." He says, as Viktor Frankl found in a Nazi concentration camp, "Our deepest rock-bottom need is not pleasure, as Freud thought, or power, as Adler thought, but meaning and purpose, a reason to live and a reason to die. We need a meaning to life more than we need life itself." He says, "Millions all around us are living the tragedy of meaningless life, the life of spiritual death. That is what makes our society most radically different from every society in history. Not that it can fly to the moon, enfranchise more voters, have the grossest national product, conquer disease, or even blow up the entire planet, but that it does not know why it exists. For," he says, "for the first time in history, society no longer regards tradition as sacred. In fact, it no longer regards tradition at all. We're the first tree that has uprooted itself from the universal soil. If we are to find an answer to the question, for what may I hope, we must find the answer individually. Our society simply does not know. The only sound we hear from our noisy society concerning the most important questions in the world is the sound of silence. How is it that the society that knows it all about everything knows nothing about everything with a capital E? How has the knowledge explosion exploded away the supreme knowledge? Why have we thrown away the roadmap just as we souped up the engine?" End quote. He wrote that in 1980. Our society, he's saying, doesn't understand that the meaninglessness of life is meant to point us to God. Rather, our society is saying, we look inward. We must find the answer individually to find what we're here for, what we should be about. Instead of looking upward, we look inward. Creef is saying that this is so ironic that a society that prides itself on knowledge can't figure out the most basic questions about life. But the interesting thing, if you think about it, is that the questions haven't disappeared. You're still asking these questions. We're still asking these questions. Your friends and family are still asking these questions in some way, shape, or form. We're all still asking. People are still wanting to know why we're here. Which again is so, why are we so interested in meaning if we came from nothing and are headed to nothing, but we're all still interested in meaning? Our life feels increasingly meaningless, but we're still interested in meaning. It's almost like there's something hardwired into us telling our operating system that there's something outside of us that we're made for, another world we're designed to live in. C.S. Lewis, in his sermon, The Weight of Glory, lays out what's called the argument from desire. The argument from desires. A desire. He says, basically, look, if God made us to commune with Him in paradise, just as He did in the garden, Adam and Eve, then if that's true, if He made us to live with God, to commune with God, then we'll find traces of that desire in our lives still today. That desire will not just disappear because of sin. He says this desire for the far-off country is an inconsolable secret. A secret, he says, we cannot hide and cannot tell. He says we cannot tell it because it's a desire for something that has never actually appeared in our experience. We cannot hide it because our experience is constantly suggesting it. Do you see what he's saying? It's like we all have this something that we don't have words for. You know, we have this experience or we have this desire for something we've not experienced. So we don't, he even says we blush at even talking about it because we don't know what to talk about. But we have this thing. But then he also says and our experience is constantly suggesting it. And it doesn't, this shouldn't take long for us to notice this. Actually, I think we struggle in our noisy society to notice these things. But do you notice what happens, not to you, but in you, when you're listening to really good music? Or what happens in you when you're having meaningful conversation with someone? what happens when you are sitting outside, soaking in whatever nature is in front of you. You're like, John, I live in an apartment. I have a patio. Ain't nothing out there. All right, well, whenever you get outside and you maybe get out of the city, you notice the glory of God in creation. Have you noticed what happens? Or maybe you're reading a good story, watching a good story, and something has stirred up in you. It's what he says. It's a desire for something that has never actually appeared in our experience. But we can't hide it because our experience is constantly suggesting it. He says we wrongly call it beauty when we hear or read or see something captivating. He says we wrongly call it beauty because it isn't something in the books or in the sunset or in the relationship, but something that comes through it. And he calls that something longing. Longing. So here's where I'm going to try to land today. Why do we have that longing? And what do you, have you noticed it? Have you noticed it? And why do we have it? What do we do with it? Have you noticed? So why did we all get so excited that the Texas Rangers won the World Series on Wednesday night? You're like, wait, what? Texas Rangers? What is that like? So none of us, I assume many of us, didn't even follow the Rangers this year, but then all of a sudden we're all excited. Why? Again, you might be like, I didn't watch one game. Okay, that's fine. So for me and Nick and Susie, why do we get excited about a team we didn't even follow? There's a longing in us to be a part of something bigger than ourselves. There's a longing in us to be in meaningful community. There's a longing for us to be a part of a group of people doing something really cool. There's a longing in us for joy. Did you see the joy on those players' faces after that last out? Just exuded with joy. Michael, you asked me what sermon illustration I was. Well, there it is. You can tell me if it works. So, do you see what happened there with the world? A baseball team we probably didn't care anything about, but all of a sudden we're watching it. We're tuned in. We're interested because there's something that's coming, not just in the thing, but through the thing that touches something in us. Again, Lewis says what came through them was longing. What do you do? What do you do with that longing? That indescribable something, that beautiful objects, beautiful stories, beautiful relationships, beautiful sunsets. What do you do with that longing that comes through those things as messengers, as a messenger? What do you do with it? That old ache that yearns for healing. Does it make you more frustrated? More focused on the toil, like, oh, there's so much toil, I can't get over the... Or does it begin to lift your eyes above the toil, above the ever-rolling stream of time, up to the eternal God who made you? Does it begin to show you that you were made for something much bigger than this world and this life? Lewis asked, what would it be to taste at the fountainhead that stream of which even these lower reaches prove so intoxicating? Okay, I know that's wordy. I'll read it again. It's so good. What would it be to taste at the fountainhead that stream which even these lower reaches prove so intoxicating? What's the fountainhead? Glory. Glory. And he goes on, yet that fountainhead, tasting that fountainhead, I believe is what lies before us. The whole man is to drink joy from the fountain of joy. And we can start to taste some of that, even in these lower reaches that prove so intoxicating. Are you thirsty? And what do you do with your thirst? Do you even notice your thirst? And how are you quenching it? As Stephanie read earlier from John 7, Jesus says, if anyone thirsts, this is not rocket surgery. This is what you do if you're thirsty. Okay? Jesus says, if you're thirsty, if anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Let him come to me and drink. He says, whoever believes in me, so coming to Jesus is believing in Jesus, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. So everyone who believes that Jesus Christ is the Son of God, who's paid their penalty on the cross, taken away all their sins, is the only sufficient sacrifice for sin, and granted has a gift of righteousness for them if they'll only trust him. Everyone who comes in simple childlike faith to the cross and says, yes, 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 I'm thirsty, please come and satisfy, come and quench, come and fill me. Then out of your heart will start to flow rivers of living water. Your thirst will be quenched. So what does all this have to do with heaven? We're doing a series on heaven. The title of this message is You Were Made for Heaven, But You Already Knew That. So I'm saying you already believe in heaven. What do I mean by that? You already believe in heaven. I think even a lot of, they wouldn't admit this, whether they admit it or not, every person on the world, every person believes in heaven, believes because eternity is in their hearts. When I say that, when I say you already believe in heaven, what I mean is that God has put eternity into your heart so that you'll sense the emptiness of life apart from God. You sense that there must be something bigger than this world. That there's this deep longing in your heart for a better world, which means you were made for another world. Of course, as Lewis famously said, mere Christianity, if I find in myself desires which nothing in this world can satisfy, the only logical explanation is that I was made for another world. So you were made for God. In a sense, you were made for heaven. You were made to know and commune with God. We sang this too. We were made to walk with Him. God made us for Himself. So we have these longings and desires. And what if these desires, these desires often go unmet, don't they? But what if the desire is a gift? The desire itself, the longing itself, that's what I'm trying to get at. What if the longing itself is a gift from God meant to lead us to Him? This is what Paul is getting at with the Athenians in Acts 17. God made from one man every nation of mankind to live on all the face of the earth, that they should seek God in the hope that they might feel their way toward Him and find Him. Yet He is not actually far from each one of us, for in Him we live and move and have our being. Or He has put eternity into our hearts. Do you see it? Do you sense it? Do you thirst? And how are you quenching your thirst? Of course, we're all quenching it in some way. When you're thirsty, you don't just sit there, right? When you're thirsty, you do something about it. So this is why when we quench our thirst with any other thing other than Christ, we're left dissatisfied. We're dissatisfied. We're never going to be satisfied until we turn to Christ. Augustine famously said, "You've made us for yourself, God, and our hearts are restless until they find rest in you." So if what I'm saying, if God made us for Himself, then it shouldn't be surprising that we will be frustrated until we put our hope in Him. That we will continually get frustrated when we turn away from Him. And what I'm trying to say, I think what the professor in Ecclesiastes is saying, is that your frustration with the punishment of time, the feeling of the meaninglessness of life, the deep ache and longing, the desire for something you can't quite name, that something outside of yourself to satisfy the deep longing of your heart, that all of that is God's way of calling you to Himself. He's trying to gently put His hand under your chin and lift your face up to Him. He's trying to let you know that you're made for something bigger than what feels like a very meaningless life. Are you listening? Are you listening? Are you drinking from the fountainhead of joy? Let's pray together. Father in heaven, please give us wisdom to understand how what we experience as a lot of meaninglessness, and how that actually teaches us something about you and something about our ultimate hope, about what we were made for, about living with you forever in a world that a world where we'll drink from the fountainhead of joy. Help us, by your Spirit, help us to lift our eyes to you so that we might fear you. Help us to eat and drink and do good and joyfully carry out our toil, all with our eyes lifted to you. Help us to understand that we don't have to understand. Help us to trust you. And I pray for any who are trying to satisfy that thirst this morning. Maybe a lot of us will try to satisfy it with religion. We'll just try to be good and be religious and look good and sound spiritual and ultimately miss the fountain of Jesus Christ. So Father, any who are not yet drinking from the fountainhead of joy that is Jesus Christ, would you turn their hearts towards your Son? We ask in Jesus' name. Amen.